anniversary, 241 years plus, of the Second Battle of Saratoga, also called the Battle of Bemis's Heights. If we were here exactly at this time, 241 years ago, you would have been hearing shots right now, right here at this very field, because the battle was in the midst of starting. We know it started at about this time, daylight savings time considered. So, you know, it's kind of cool to be here at this moment, again, 241 years ago in the future. And at a place that's so important, the Second Battle of Saratoga, like I mentioned earlier, is one of those many, many, many battles in the Revolutionary War that had major consequences. Some battles that were fought, you know, they happened. They're important for the sake of the battle itself, and of course the people involved in those battles. Sometimes they're, you know, if they're dead, if they're severely wounded, if they have seen the horrors of war, those battles on a personal level are terrifying and terrible. And if you're dead, of course, it puts a period to your life. But in other cases, other battles are incredibly important because of the results of what happened. Political, military kinds of results. And that's what we have here in the Battle of Bemis's Heights. So one of the most decisive battles ever fought right here at Bemis's Heights. Now, if you don't believe me, you might believe the New York Times Magazine. The New York Times Magazine, back in 1999, they came out with an issue called The Best Ideas, Stories, and Inventions of the Last 1,000 Years. And various editors went through a series of different subjects and topics, running the gamut of best musical instrument, best ship, best tool, you know, things like this. And they were trying to rate the best of whatever those subjects were within the past 1,000 years, the past millennium. So, best battle was, guess what? This one right here. The Battle of Bemis's Heights. According to the editor, R.W. Appel, he said that the Battle of Bemis's Heights, which caused Burgoyne's army to surrender, was the most important battle in the whole world in the past 1,000 years. And I tell you right now, when we saw that issue, somebody gave us a copy, you know, it's like, wow. What a surprise. We didn't know about it. I mean, obviously we knew about it. We knew that the Battle of Saratoga were the most important ever, clearly. But that the New York Times... But the New York Times Magazine put it in print was really neat. And, you know, there's no collusion on our part or anything like that. So take it from the New York Times. They gave us that great honor. So there's a lot to talk about related to the build-up to the Second Battle of Saratoga, but... very briefly, I'll do it as briefly as I can. The year is 1777. The British Army from Canada, that's what it's called, the Army from Canada, commanded by General John Burgoyne, is marching on its way to Albany. That's their destination point. They're gunning for Albany. General Burgoyne had set off from Canada in June. And by September, months later, he was here. About 40, 35, 40-odd miles north of Albany. So you see, he's traversed all this way. He's come quite a distance. He fought various battles, elements of his army, like the Battle of Hubbardton, the Battle of Fort Anne, the Battle of Bennington. Some of these were successful for his army, some of them were not. But eventually, it's September, he's here, and you have, on the 19th of September, the First Battle of Saratoga fought. The First Battle of Saratoga was fought primarily at Freeman's Farm, which is about 3/4 of a mile to the northeast of us. The reason why the British have to fight the Americans at Freeman's Farm is because the American army, under the command of General Horatio Gates, has put up defenses at Bemis's Heights. That's stop 2 and stop 3 on our tour road, so it's about a mile plus south of us. The American army is down there, strengthened behind their defenses. They know that the British are going to be marching on the west side, this side, of the Hudson River. They figure that the British are gunning for Albany. And so they set up the defenses. They have over 8,000 troops. General Burgoyne doesn't have many more than that himself. So the American army's pretty confident about their positions, which are really well built, thanks to the Polish engineer, Tadeusz Kościuszko, the architect of the American defenses at Bemis's Heights. The defenses are really strong. The natural landscape is incredible with all those ravines that are right in front of the lines of defense. The American army has a brilliant position to defend themselves. And when on the 19th of September they hear that the British are on their way to attack them, Benedict Arnold, the de facto second-in-command of the army under Gates' command, Arnold decides, with Gates' permission, that it would be better to go out and attack the British out in the fields and on the farms and in the woods, rather than allowing the British to come up and attack the defenses. And so Gates thinks it's a good idea. Arnold brings the battle to the British. The Battle of Freeman's Farm occurs. It's a tactical British win because the British win the Battle of Freeman's Farm. The Americans retreated after the end of the day. At the end of the day, the Americans retreated. They lost the battle, tactically speaking. But strategically, the Americans held the edge because the Americans still had their defenses at Bemis's Heights. They still blocked the way to Albany. Burgoyne's army is an isolated army, right? He has no friends to the north or west or the east, and certainly not to the south. So in order for him to get to his destination, Albany, he has to get there as soon as possible, because every day that goes by, he's losing men through attrition, skirmishes with the Americans, deserters leaving his army, and he's running out of food. He only has a finite amount of food with his army. Every day that goes by, they're running through food pretty fast. He only has enough food to last him until about toward the end of October, let's say. So it's, you know, the middle of September, you had this battle fought. After the battle, Burgoyne has a day of rest and reorganization for his troops. The following day, Sunday the 21st of September, Burgoyne gets a secret letter from the British commander in New York City, Sir Henry Clinton. And this letter promised Burgoyne that if he wants, he, Clinton, the British general in New York, would come up with an army and rip through the Hudson Highlands, capture Fort Montgomery, capture Fort Clinton, create havoc and devastation in the Hudson Highlands, so much so that General Gates up here will have to split his force in half so as to see to the threat in the Hudson Highlands. Surely Gates won't let the Hudson Highlands fall to ruin with Clinton's attack from New York. That's what the British are thinking. General Burgoyne that very day responds, and I quote, "Do it, my friend, directly." He writes a little note, "Do it, my friend, directly." And the letter, a little note rather, is sent to Clinton. So Burgoyne decides then and there that the best thing for him to do is to sit and wait. He's going to build up defenses, lay out camps, almost as if he's a general on the defensive, in a way, because he's building fortifications, he's building redoubts and fortified walls. They're putting the cannons in the walls through the embrasures, just in case the Americans attack them, even though the British are the ones that are on the offensive. That's what Burgoyne is thinking. He's hoping that this diversion will occur in the Hudson Highlands, weakening Gates' army, and then when word of the weakened army arrives in Burgoyne's camp, then he'll say, okay, time to attack. 2.5 weeks pass by. That's how long it went. Not 2.5 days, but 2.5 weeks. General Burgoyne is in his camp 2.5 weeks, just sitting there, building more fortifications, sending forces out to forage around the landscape, trying to bring in more food and fodder for the horses. You know, desertions are occurring. It got so bad amongst the Germans in particular that General Riedesel, the German commander, Burgoyne's third in command of the army, actually had to put out an order to his German troops, saying in effect, this is not an exact quote, but saying in effect, because so many desertions are occurring amongst our German troops with Burgoyne's army, the desertion rate is so high, we are from now on going to double the numbers of troops in every guard, say from 10 to 20, or from 20 to 40, therefore making it less likely to desert if you're in a larger group than you are in a tiny group. He also added, and this is the part that's really mind-blowing, he also added, if you as a German soldier spot a fellow German soldier trying to desert to the enemy, you may capture him and you receive 10 guineas, which are 10 gold coins. If you can't capture him, you can shoot him, and if you shoot him dead, you receive 5. That's how desperate they were. They're threatening death by allowing soldiers to shoot you for money you know, if you're found to be a probable deserter. So this is, again, showing you how desperate they are. But of course, the whole army is suffering from a lack of food. General Burgoyne had to cut the men's and women's and children's rations. Their flour ration was cut back by a third. So they were living on reduced rations. So things are not going well for General Burgoyne. And how many letters of communication do you think he was getting from General Clinton? Remember, on the 21st of September, he had sent that one letter to General Clinton, "Do it, my friend, directly." Did Clinton send a response? He tried. He tried a few times, but the responses aren't getting through. The American army controls completely the upper Hudson Highlands, as well as the whole area of Albany, and anywhere between Albany and General Burgoyne's army itself. So no messages are coming through. General Burgoyne, imagine being General Burgoyne. You're kind of gambling that this diversion thing's going to work in the first place, but you're also gambling that it's even happening because you have no information about whether it's actually going on or not. You have no data coming in. So after 2.5 weeks, General Burgoyne decides that he has to do something. It's the 7th of October now, the day of the Battle of Bemis Heights. He knows he only has a couple of weeks worth of rations left, so he better do something, and he better do it now. This is the plan he came up with. He's going to march out of his defenses, out of his fortified camp, and the army, or not army, but the expedition force that he creates, which is going to be 1,500 officers and men, they're going to march to the southwest in this direction. And they're going to march to the southwest, edging to the west, but also to the south, because they're hoping to get toward the American lines of defense. They're looking to try to get as close to the western portion of the American lines of defense as they can. When they get close enough to see the lines of defense, Burgoyne, who is with this probing force of 1,500 men that's sent out that day, is going to, with his spyglass, determine upon sight whether or not, and he'll have aides with him too to corroborate, commiserate, and make a decision about whether or not this is going to work. They're going to decide then and there if the American lines look weak enough to attack. They'll attack, the British will, with the entire army the following day. On the 8th of October, the whole force will attack. The next day, the 8th of October. If, however, the defensive lines that the Americans have look too strong to attack, like there's no way the British will bust through them, then Burgoyne will simply return to camp with his probing force and then wait until the 11th of October. So they'll wait a few more days, which Burgoyne figures that's as long as he can do it. That's the extreme amount of time he can wait before he's then going to begin to withdraw to the north and go back, which is something that he actually promised not to do. As crazy as it is, generals, when they're marching hither and yon and they have to write orders to their troops during the course of their campaigns, they generally don't say things like, and I quote, "This army will not retreat." General Burgoyne actually said that in general orders toward the beginning of the campaign. "This army will not retreat." So you can imagine Burgoyne's own word and reputation is on the line as much as the success or failure of his army's arms. So General Burgoyne, he is going to have this 1,500-man probing force formed. It's going to consist of most troops drawn out in detachments from across the entire army, Germans and Loyalists and British alike. They're going to have some French-Canadian militia, and they're going to have some Indians as well, mostly Mohawk warriors and warriors from the Seven Nations of Canada. So 1,500 officers and men with 10 pieces of artillery. They're going to march out in the very, very late morning. They actually break up into three separate columns. They have a complicated movement. No reason to explain exactly how it occurred, but eventually they all end up here. They combine their three columns and they end up right here. Now, what was here exactly? Today we call it the Barber Wheat Field. The only thing that we absolutely for a fact know is that in this wheat field was a certain kind of crop growing, wheat indeed. As for the Barber connection, we do know that the Barber family had this field later on, post-Revolutionary War. But we cannot absolutely, positively say that the Barber family was here in 1777. They may have been. If they were, the place had been abandoned. Like most people living around here who were on the side of the revolution, they had abandoned their homes. They did not want to be around when the British are going to be coming through the area. So they had abandoned their homes. The place was abandoned, except for the fact that there were some American sentinels on duty. Sentinels out and about on the property, because of course the Americans, being clever and smart, they have their defenses a good mile plus south of us, but they have a series of outposts and screens, the northernmost of which was this right here at the wheat field. They had a series of sentinels, and you know, when you have about a dozen sentinels standing by, now you see 1500 men coming at you, you're going to take a few shots at them and then of course run away. There's no way that they're going to try to stand against 1500 guys on a march. So the 1,500 guys arrive here at the wheat fields. Two things happen. First of all, General Burgoyne thinks, okay, so far so good. We scattered some paltry sentinels, but there's wheat here. There's wheat. And believe me, the British need grain for their army, to sustain their army. Remember, their rations, the soldiers and women and children's rations had been cut. So they need to sustain themselves with this wheat. What a perfect opportunity. They had been foraging to the north and to the east, not to the south, though, and not to the west, because the Americans more or less controlled this area in the time between the battles of Saratoga. So now that they're here, they're thinking, okay, let's go get the grain. So the soldiers are ordered to line up on this road. One German officer called it, and I quote, a damned crooked road. So this is our, quote, damned crooked road that stretched through this wheat field, not a wheat field today, but pretend, through a grove of trees into another wheat field. There was actually another wheat field beyond this one. You can almost see below the trunks of the, the branches of the trees over there. You see there seems to be a field on the other side of those trees. There was another wheat field over there, in fact. So these two wheat fields were adjacent to each other with just some forest in between them. So the British line, again, the Germans, everybody else, they're lined up with their 10 pieces of artillery. They're lined up on this damned crooked road, and they're spread out. They're ordered to sit down on the ground, and the British command orders carts and wagons to be brought up from the camp so that they can start to harvest the grain, plop it in the carts and wagons, and bring it back into camp. And the soldiers are going to have to sit down because they'll be here for hours and hours while this process undergoes. And Burgoyne thought it essential enough to stall his primary objective because of the need for that wheat. And so they're out here, they're lined up, sitting down. You can imagine the foragers harvesting the wheat. There was a house kind of where you see that little rise in the center of the field right over there. There was a house in that area. No longer with us, but there was a house there. General Burgoyne's staff, not him himself, but General Burgoyne's staff were told to get up on top of that house. Somehow they scaled the roof. We don't know how. They got on top of the roof, and with their spy glasses, they're trying to find the American lines of defense. They're looking to see if they can see anything from this point. They know, they figure they're about a mile plus away still from the American lines, but they're hoping they can see something. They can't. They can see nothing because of the canopy trees. Today, our treescape is very attractive and pretty, but the trees are kind of low. You know, they're kind of low. This is new growth forest. All of these trees that you're seeing, these are trees that have grown up since the 20th century. If we were here in the 18th century, there would have been almost a sense of claustrophobia because we would have been in within a wall, surrounded by a wall of trees. The trees were so high, and the officers on that rooftop could see nothing to the south. There was no way to see anything. So that's the British situation. Now let's go over to our heroes, our protagonists here we have in the American camp. I told you about the sentinels, right? The sentinels had fired their shots, and now they're going scurrying back to the main American lines. And of course, they have a system and chain of drummers that are going to drumbeat, and then messengers on horseback, officers getting further information about what's going on. Well, we happen to know from the memoir of a lieutenant colonel who was dining that early afternoon, you have dinner in the 18th century typically in the early afternoon. They were dining, as he says, on an ox's heart. He says, I'll never forget it. We were eating an ox's heart early that afternoon. That's what they were eating. And who was with him? This is John Brooks, by the way. He's a lieutenant colonel from Massachusetts. Who's with him? Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold. The three of them are dining together at Gates's headquarters. Now, at this point, I have to ask the question. Overconfident in what way?
By the English, like, you know, I can take my wife and kids, I'll still hunt you down.
Well, beyond that, and here comes the second point. Women particularly formed a very, very important support role for the military forces. Let's look at the British Army in particular. Guess who's doing all the washing for the British and German soldiers? Women. Soldiers aren't washing for themselves. Usually it's going to be women. Women do the washing. Who's going to be doing the nursing in the hospitals? Women are going to be doing the nursing. Who's going to be repairing clothing or even sometimes making the military garments by orders from the command, the British command? It's going to be women. I do want to point out, this is not slave labor. These women are not forced to do it because they're told to do it. It's not like soldiers are getting paid to be soldiers, but women, we'll make them do all this work for nothing. No, not at all. They're paid for these different duties. They're paid to be nurses. They're paid by the piece for the garments they make or repair, and they are paid for washing, nursing duties. So yeah, they're paid for these things. Who cooks for the men? Men cook for the men. Which is funny, you go to a typical reenactment, you see women cooking, you know, over hearth and home for the soldiers, you know, it's not the way it was in the 18th century. Generally speaking, men cooked for themselves. Women, of course, did cook for themselves, and, you know, it wouldn't be atypical for a woman to cook for her husband, but not every man was able to bring his wife upon campaign either. There were restrictions. In General Burgoyne's army, the rule was that each company was allowed to bring three women. A company in the British Army at full strength is 64 officers and men. For the Germans, it's a little over 100 officers and men. So three women per every 60-some or 100-some odd people, you know, not a ton, but still, certainly enough to be noticed. Yeah, certainly enough to provide that important support for the forces, because they needed it. They needed it.
Thank you.
Sure, you bet. All right, so from here, what we'll do is we'll caravan out to stop number 7, the Bremen Fortified Camp, and we will finish the tour of the Battle of Bienenstocks. Out. A redoubt, though, is an enclosed fortification. This was anything but a redoubt. Back in the 1970s, the archaeologist Dean Snow, who recently wrote a book about the battles of Saratoga called 1777, he and his team were able to uncover the actual outline of Bremen's fortified defense right here. Where you see the white posts with the red tops, that shows you where the outlines of that fortified wall were located. Now they stretch from, you see that one post right there, kind of at the top of this little rise? They stretch from there all the way over here. There were two cannons right there. And then it stretched all the way down to that one lone post. And there it ended. This fortification wall faces to the northwest. There's no backing to this fortified wall. In fact, the camp for the garrison was down here. That's where they camped. There was no cannons facing that way, no fortified wall facing that way. Instead, the fortified wall faced that way. Now, does anybody want to hazard a guess as to where the American camp was? Yes, that's right. That way. I don't know. Maybe you'd want to put up a defense facing toward the enemy. Now, if you're thinking, okay, the archaeologists, they find some wall. But does that mean that that's all there was? Yeah, it does. You know why? We can confirm it on two British maps that both show, by different artists, both show that that's exactly what this fortified wall was. That's all it was, a fortified wall facing to the northwest. Archaeology confirmed it, and it just so happens that one of the staff officers who was garrisoned here at this very fort, a guy by the name of Heinrich Hulig, he writes, he's a German, he writes between the battles of Saratoga, talking about how the details of the construction of this fortification, that's what he describes. So it all fits together. The maps, the letters, and the archaeology. It's perfect. So then we have to ask ourselves, what the heck were they thinking? A wall facing this way? Okay. I mean, if the Americans were going to try to come around and envelop, they call it envelop when you try to surround the enemy. If you're going to try to envelop Burgoyne's fortified camp, you'd probably want a defense facing northwest. That's a good idea, sure. But if you're going to leave the back exposed, what's the point? We don't know why. But it gets worse, if you thought that was bad. You see this little rise right over here? You see that little hill right over here? Which is the high point within Bremen's fortified camp. This little hill right here. As you can see to the front of us, to the northwest of us, there's a hill that's even higher than that. Now, there is a small fortification. That's what that little, it's like that box-shaped, that square-shaped fortification. They had a couple of logs up there to defend themselves. They can put, you know, maybe a half a dozen guys in it. That's about it. So you have the fortified wall, but just in front of the fortified wall, you have an even bigger hill with a what they call blind spot behind that. I mean, right? If we were all to assemble and attack this fortification, wouldn't it be the smartest thing for us to do is to hide behind that hill so that the cannons can't even touch us? The guys with muskets and rifles inside the fort, there were some riflemen here that the Germans had, they couldn't touch us. That would be the smart thing to do. And as you'll find out, that's exactly what the Americans did. Who's to blame for this travesty of engineering? Well, we don't know, except this guy, this staff officer, Ulig. He writes between the battles, and he talks about the building of the fortification, and he actually says that Colonel Bremen, the commander of the overall defense right here, Colonel Bremen wants the fortification wall to be built on the hill to the front. So Bremen's no idiot. Bremen wants it to be built on the hill to the front rather than back here. And Ulig only says that, and I quote, "but the English engineer disagrees." That's all he says. The English engineer disagrees. Now, it happens that there were three English engineers here with Burgoyne's army. We got to blame one of them. There's William Twiss, John James Robertson, and Benjamin Slack. Now, I don't know about you, but I think Benjamin Slack, right? Sounds like the guy who might have been the one who maybe slacked off and didn't do his job. I'm just saying. By the way, that's no joke. It could have been him. It was one of the three. But yeah, Benjamin Slack, why not him? So an English engineer apparently designed this fortification, which, as we can see, you know, very poorly designed. It was supposed to be defended by about 550-odd German soldiers. These are the German grenadiers, the guys with the tall caps, you know, with the metal fronts, with the mustaches. These guys are supposed to be the tough, strong soldiers, veteran soldiers, on average higher than an average soldier, guys that have some experience under their belt. They also here have the German light infantry. These guys are younger, agile, able to run around and do things faster than people my age. And then they have Jäger. Anybody know what Jäger means in German?
Hunter.
Were you going to say hunter too? Yeah, sure. Hunter, right. Yeah. Jäger means hunter. Hunter, in this context, is a guy with a rifle. They had riflemen here. Rifles that had bayonets, no less. So these guys were ready to go. I mean, there's only 50 of them, but, you know, it's better than none. So these guys are ready to go to defend their fortification if it came under attack. Again, about 550-odd soldiers. But there's a little flaw to the plan. When General Burgoyne formed his probing force, and it had been sent out earlier in the day, the 1,500 men, guess where they drew their troops heavily from? Right here. I kid you not, they decided to take half the garrison and go out with the probing force. Half the Balcarres Redoubt garrison went with the probing force, as well as many elements for the rest of the army. But for the purposes of this is a big deal. If half the garrison is sent away, that leaves little more than 200 guys remaining behind. Okay, they got their two light six-pounders manned by Hessians. That's good. But now their grenadiers, their light infantry, their Jägers, they're at 50% strength. Now, the commander is here. Brightman, he stays behind. He stays here to command the fort. But so many of the other officers had gone off on the expedition with Burgoyne earlier in the day. So if something goes wrong, you might have a command and control situation if so many of your officers have gone off on the probing force. I'm just saying. So now we come to it, the 7th of October. As we already described, the Americans were attacking the Balcarres Redoubt, as we call it today. And the Balcarres Redoubt was not failing. It was not caving in. The Americans could not capture it. It was just too strong. Benedict Arnold was part of that attack. He was trying to direct the American forces forward. And even though they were able, the Americans were able to capture two small satellite fortifications in front of the redoubt, they weren't able to actually capture the redoubt itself. And so the Americans backed off, and they received some bombardment fire from the British howitzers and cannons, but they still stood their ground trying to see if they could make a better plan of attack. Well, simultaneous to this, when this attack was going on and failing just to the south of us at the Balcarres Redoubt, other American forces, primarily Colonel Daniel Morgan heading up the riflemen, Major Henry Dearborn heading up the American Corps of Light Infantry, composed of New England Continental Troops, they are going to come crashing through the woods, and they're going to see the Bremen fortification, which they knew it was here. During the 2.5 weeks between the battles of Saratoga, the Americans had basically control of all, you know, things that were not right within Burgoyne's camp. So they fully had intelligence about the location of where General Burgoyne's different defenses were. So they knew it was here. And when they come crashing through the woods, you can imagine they saw their opportunity, because they must have known the weakness of the fortification, no back door to it, so to speak. The front was all that it had, plus the big hill in the front. I mean, what better kind of way to attack it than to attack through the opening and to gather your forces behind that hill and then attack when you've collected your forces? That's exactly what they did. Morgan's Rifle Corps, Dearborn's Light Infantry, most of them are going to go on the far side of this open field. The Germans inside can little more than to take some shots at them, maybe shoot a couple cannon shots. But the Americans are hardly going to be hit by any of that. They're going to go right behind this big old hill. Nobody inside this fortification can shoot at them, to say nothing of seeing them. I mean, they're hidden so well. At this same time, other American regiments, because Benedict Arnold had been ordering out so many overwhelming numbers of forces to attack the British at the wheat fields, and now those forces are, you know, they're not working against the Balcarres Redoubt, but other American forces are going to try to strike here. They're going to come out of the woods, and they're going to start to form on the south side, that south over that way, on the south side of this field. The Germans, the defenders, the cannons, that's not really going to, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything about that. So the Germans start to focus on what's developing over there. And almost like it was planned. I mean, we don't know how it was done. You'd imagine that they had some kind of confab among some of the officers about, okay, when we do this, then you guys attack simultaneously. You know, we don't know that, but it seems to have been the way it worked. American troops are going to strike at the big, big, huge opening on the back of this fortification, and at the same time, hundreds of American troops are going to pour over this hilltop. Now, if you're thinking, well, they're attacking the cannons, they're attacking the wall, why would they do that? Remember, please, that the wall ends right there. Literally, that white and red post, that's where the wall ended. So, really, opposite that hill is a big open area that they can just pour right through and attack and outflank the defenders of this fortification. So, it was just a brilliant move. In fact, if we go down this way, we can get close to where the big event happened. The capture of the fortification and the severe wounding of one of the American generals. So here we have it at Bremen's fortified camp. The very tip tail end of the fortified line. The American camp is that way. The Americans, of course, were coming from the woods over there. So this was completely open. The camp back here where the woods are now, that's where the Germans, the German defenders had their personal belongings, blankets, their food, the women and children, the soldiers' wives and children for the garrison were in camp. One of the Americans, a couple of the Americans talked about how when they captured this post, that the German soldiers were cooking their suppers over their fires because it was, you know, coming time for supper. So the battle, like I said, was developing. The soldiers coming over the hill to the front of Freiman's camp, my camp, right here, headed up by about a dozen riflemen, commanded by their major, Joseph Morris, of the 1st New Jersey Regiment. They're being led right through here. You can imagine some riflemen just taking advantage of some wayward German soldiers here on the flank, perhaps, who were focused on what was going on over there. We don't know exactly why and how, but they were backed up by a whole lot, hundreds of Continental troops coming up with them, including Benedict Arnold. This is the place, somewhere right here, where Benedict Arnold was severely wounded in the left leg. You see, he had been part of the attack at the Balcarres Redoubt, and it wasn't going well, but he saw what was developing over here. He saw the potential of American forces, his troops, to be able to capture this fortification, and he wanted to be part of it. He wanted to help with that attack. So he rides across the field, rides this vale over here, joins up with Major Morris's dozen riflemen, and he's there, you can imagine him, on horseback, sword in hand, and at some point, somewhere in this vicinity, he was shot in the left leg, somewhere near the ankle. That's where he was shot. Not in the thigh, as some people, some historians sometimes write in their books by mistake, but he was shot near the ankle of the left leg. His horse is killed from under him. The horse drops, Arnold drops. Horse falls on Arnold. You know, it's a kind of a big mess. And Arnold, he's not mortally wounded, of course, unfortunately, considering what happens years later. Yes, I said it. indeed, he'll never be the same again. His leg is so severely damaged that while his leg is never amputated, you know, it's not removed from his body, he's going to need assistance to get around, either with people or, of course, with crutches or a cane at the very least. Benedict Arnold, the senior American commander here, severely wounded. What about Colonel Breiman? Well, Colonel Breiman had a reputation, and this is not just anecdotal. I mean, this is something that's actually documented in the journals and letters of his fellow German officers during the course of the campaigns of 1776 and 1777. Some of them actually wrote in their personal correspondence about how Breiman was a real stickler for punishment. Breiman apparently loved to punish. There was an incident that happened before the battles of Saratoga where a German was, I think, accused of desertion, and the man was sentenced to have to run the gauntlet 6 times. Now, running the gauntlet can be a death sentence. You can imagine long rows of soldiers, each of which have sticks and clubs in their hands, and the offender has to run between the lines 6 times. And as you're running through the gauntlet, your job as a soldier in the line is to beat the soldier as he's running by. And you could die from this punishment. Now, the Germans loved to have their soldiers run the gauntlet. They didn't like the flogging thing that the Americans preferred, and certainly the British preferred. They liked to have their soldiers run the gauntlet. Well, Breiman ordered the guy to run the gauntlet 6 times, and the guy died on, I believe, the 4th go about. He never made it to 6. He died. So they had an autopsy. They did autopsies in the 18th century. They had an autopsy of the dead soldier because the autopsy was ordered, I believe, by General Riedesel. And Breiman, according to the surgeon who wrote about this, interceded and instructed the head surgeon to ensure that the findings of the autopsy proved that the beating did not cause his death. Why? Well, because if you beat your soldiers to death, even though they're not supposed to die in a punishment, and they would have given him a death sentence if they meant that. No, they just wanted to punish him to set an example and the like. But if this kind of thing actually ends up killing soldiers on a regular basis, well, then Colonel Breiman won't have his fun anymore. That's my interpretation. But Colonel Breiman definitely does not want the finding to show that the beatings killed the guy. And so the head surgeon actually came to the conclusion that while the man died at the same time he was being beaten, the autopsy proved that he had other flaws in his body cavity, which ended up causing his death at the same time. This is unbelievable. And the German surgeon, a guy by the name of Julius Vosmus, he actually writes in his journal saying this is insanity. Of course, Colonel B. blank, you know, even it's his own personal journal, he's writing like that. Colonel B. got his way to make sure that the running the gauntlet punishment continues, in the future. So here we are, the Second Battle of Saratoga. The American attack is so overwhelming that Germans begin to retreat. According to one German account written in 1777, the guy says, this German officer states that when the German soldiers were retreating, trying to save themselves, run through the woods to save themselves, Colonel Breyman pulled out his sword and started to kill the German soldiers trying to run away, started stabbing them. And according to this one German officer, Breyman had killed 4 of his own German soldiers to try to make, you know, keep them back at their posts, you know, basically showing them, hey, I'll kill you if you try to run, stand your ground. Upon killing the 4th man, though, he was bayoneted to death by his own troops. That's what one of the German officers said. So ends the Colonel Breyman. He was left behind. Theoretically, he's buried out here somewhere in an unmarked grave, along with so many other German and indeed American soldiers as well, who lost their lives here. And at the wheat fields as well. They were buried right in situ, for the most part. They were not removed to a hospital or something like that. If they were found dead right there on the ground, they would bury them near where they had been. So Colonel Breitman's dead. The Germans are running pell-mell through the woods. The Americans capture this fortification, and because of the darkness, it's, 7 o'clock, 7:30, somewhere in there, 6:30 and 7:30, somewhere in there. That's about all we know. The times differ depending on who's writing about it. It's too dark to pursue. The Americans are very afraid that if they try to pursue the enemy in the dark, that they'll have friendly fire incidents and it'll be a big mess. So the Americans halt their progress. They know they've won an incredible, decisive victory. And the fort is maintained. The Americans maintain a garrison here throughout the night. The capture of Breyman's fortified lines right here is the thing that causes General Burgoyne to retreat the following day with his entire army. If we look at a map, you will find that Burgoyne's entire defenses face south, except this one. This one guarded, call it the back door, to the road that extended behind his entire lines of defense. And that road went all the way down to the river, which is where he had his provisions, his food, his hospital, his artillery park, the baggage, the refugees, American refugees who have joined Burgoyne's army seeking refuge against the American oppressors. So that road was clear and open for the Americans if they wanted to march on it the next day on the 8th. And Burgoyne understood that. So he consolidated his forces that night. The next day on the 8th of October, he began his fateful retreat north. And like I said, 10 days after this Second Battle of Saratoga, he ended up surrendering his army because there was absolutely no way he could escape. There was certainly no way he could get to Albany. Before we end the tour, though, I would like to go down to the most famous monument that we have here at Saratoga Battlefield, the Booth Monument.
Eric, were there other light horse in the attack? I know Arnold was on horse. Were there other light horse? Do we know?
No, no. There were light horse on the American side that had an entire regiment of light horse militia. Yeah. They also had a troop of light dragoons from the Continental Army. Yeah. The Second Continental
but not here that day.
Not in the fight. Yeah. Not in the fight. I mean, they were in the camp, but they were not like
yeah.
The Connecticut, yeah, the Connecticut militia were all attacking the wheat fields, but they were also attacking the Balcarres Redoubt. Horace Brigade was the brigade that unfortunately made that assault on the Balcarres Redoubt, and they were never sent up here. This was specifically, you had Morgan and Dearborn, who I mentioned Massachusetts Continentals in general, but particularly it's Putnam's and Nixon's regiments and Lernert's brigade, which consists of James Livingston's battalion of forces, which has New Yorkers and Connecticut men and New Englanders in it, other New Englanders in it.
But no Connecticut regiments were attacking here. So here we have the famous boot monument. Has anybody seen this before?
Nope.
Sure, great, good. Yeah, the boot monument, if you look on the front, it has what is, you can tell a howitzer barrel. There's a boot there with an epaulette, that's that frilly thing on top of the boot. The epaulette has two stars, which allude to the idea that the wearer would be a major general. I would like to point out that starred epaulettes were not used yet in the Continental Army. In fact, the way you could tell General Gates and General Arnold, their rank, is not by stars on their epaulettes. That comes a little later in the war. But you know what they actually wore? Ribbons, big white ribbons. And for a commander-in-chief like George Washington, the only commander-in-chief, his ribbon, if you've seen it in portraits or paintings, do you know what color that was? Yes, it's a light blue color, that's right, a light blue color. But now it gets really crazy. For a major general like Gates, like Arnold, theirs were purple ribbons. And if you're a brigadier general like Enoch Poor, Ebenezer Lerner, John Glover, so many other brigadier generals here, yours is pink. Pink ribbons. I'm not kidding. Yep, that's what they wear. So you can imagine Benedict Arnold wounded with his big purple, call it a sash, if you will, a silk sash. But anyway, that does allude to the idea that he's a major general. Laurel wreaths, of course, with a kind of a crown on the top there. The inscription, though, is on the back. The back shows you what gives you an inscription. And it says here, erected 1887 by John Watts de Peyster, Brevet Major General, State of New York, Second Vice President, Saratoga Monument Association. In memory of the, quote, most brilliant soldier, quote, of the Continental Army, who was desperately wounded on this spot, the sally port of Burgoyne's great Western Redoubt. It's not accurate, it's the Bremen Redoubt. The 7th of October, 1777, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution and for himself the rank of Major General. In truth, and this is where, you know, monuments and history get muddled, in truth, Arnold had been a Major General for months. But what he did get here, and this is kind of what the guy was getting confused, what he did get here was a promotion within rank. After the battle was fought here, Horatio Gates writes a letter to John Hancock reporting about the battle. And he tells Hancock saying that, and I quote, the gallant General Arnold was wounded in that fight. And so he calls Arnold gallant, which is very interesting. And Congress shortly thereafter holds a vote. And they vote to promote, it's a little indirect, they vote to tell Washington that he, Washington, is now empowered to fix Arnold's seniority within the rank of Major General. And so Washington actually takes the liberty to promote him 2 days ahead of five other general officers, which is beyond what Benedict Arnold ever wanted. So if Benedict Arnold ever had a complaint about not being, you know, some senior Major General, which he had, that was a legit complaint he had for a while, he eventually got more than what he wanted, thanks to his brave actions here in the Second Battle of Saratoga. And frankly, you know, as we all know, Benedict Arnold was a treacherous traitor to the United States. But here, the Second Battle of Saratoga was very much his genius. And it really happened the way it did. It was as decisive as it was thanks to him. So Benedict Arnold was a hero of the battles of Saratoga for sure. Does anybody have any questions? This does end the tour.
Is it true that he asked Morgan's men to take out Fraser? Is that true?
So, in the 19th century, you start to see a development of these anecdotal dialogue-laced stories, which have, if I may forgive me, no credibility to any connection to people who are actually there. They're just, they're invented. And there are so many variants of them, and they become outrageous as time goes on. You can see, I've done a study, in fact, on that very one, how one historian will build off of another and they'll add more dialogue and they'll really describe it. My favorite in the end, because the initial one was pretty mild, like Arnold was telling Morgan to tell his rifleman to shoot, you know, General Fraser. Well, eventually it comes out, I forgot the date of this one, it's like 1880s, maybe even earlier, it might have been earlier than that, where Arnold supposedly told Morgan to have his rifleman shoot at that general, the British general, because, and I quote, he is a host of evil spirits. Evil spirits. I mean, it's crazy. You know, these kind of wacky narratives that come out. We do know for sure, and Morgan is he actually admits to this in an interview he had with the British officer toward the tail end of the war, a captured British officer. Because the captured British officer was asking him about Saratoga, because General Fraser was one of the most famous generals in the war, and of course, because he was mortally wounded and died, you know, that's kind of a powerful moment. And so it was kind of infamous to the British, and they wanted to know more about it, the circumstances. And all that Daniel Morgan could say, because from his recollections, was that he did order some of his riflemen to shoot at mounted officers in the Second Battle of Saratoga. And he did recall, according to this British officer who wrote about it, that he remembers seeing one of the officers downed by one of his riflemen's shots. But he couldn't say it was Fraser. And in truth, there were a couple of British officers on horseback who were shot off their horses. The other famous guy is Sir Francis Clarke. He was Burgoyne's junior aide-de-camp. He was mounted on horseback, Second Battle of Saratoga, and he was shot off his horse, mortally wounded, just like Fraser, except he was captured. The Americans were able to capture Sir Francis, yeah. So they brought Sir Francis back to Burgoyne's headquarters, I'm sorry, Gates' headquarters, and then they brought him down eventually to Albany, where he was cared for, and he ended up dying on the 15th of October, because he was, like I said, mortally wounded. So there were a couple of officers that could fit the bill for. So if it's hard to say.
I just don't know.
Yeah. Thank you. Sure, you bet.
Is there any information from any Burgoyne's later writings about what he really intended? I mean, because it's a ton of different forwards, because he discovers if he actually made it close enough to American lines to see them, he would be more explosive with a larger wheat field, right? Which you then so what would you think? And the fact that he stopped to get the wheat is what he was going to fall to go much further.
Yeah.
So what would you think?
This is the subject you could write a book on. It has there's been a lot of study on this very question. And Burgoyne, in fact, did write about this quite a bit in, it's published in his book, The State of the Expedition to Canada in 1780. And when you read what he wrote, it is very obvious that he is mixing fact and purpose that he had in 1777 with his new purpose in 1779-80, which is to clear his name, because he does actually change some of the thought processes. We know this for a fact because in 1777 you actually have the original orders that explain very in a great detail what his intentions are on the 7th of October. Basically, in fact, if you have an email, I'd be happy to forward you. I could send you a paper on this very subject. Basically, what it is when he goes out on the 7th of October, his first job is to reconnoiter. He's not going out there to forage outright, but he is aware that foraging opportunities might be found, and if so, that he'll take advantage of them. So when he goes out there, he draws heavily for his troop strength from Ryman's Reserve Corps and Fraser's Advanced Corps, which was at the Balcarres Redoubt. The thinking being that if they sapped the strengths from the rest of the British line, that would leave them weak to attack by the Americans. And there was no way that they could be saved, you know. So in other words, if let's just say Burgoyne's probing force consisted completely of troops from the Hudson River Valley, you know, for example, and that Hudson River Valley came under attack by Americans because it did come under attack the day before, on the 6th of October, the British were kind of, they had this, fear that the Americans would try something like that. So Burgoyne thought, well, okay, if I leave those defenses intact, more or less, if I take the balance of the personnel for the probing force from these two western fortifications, and then we go out in a southwesterly direction, if we're attacked, and Burgoyne's there with them, so nobody's going to plow through Burgoyne, you know, it's just that kind of, bravado that he has. Nobody's going to plow through him, but if they do, then the retreating forces will simply go back to their fortifications of origin. That didn't happen. Everybody went back to the Balcarres Redoubt. Nobody returned here because Burgoyne never anticipated that they could be in any way possibly so overwhelmed. That never occurred to him. But to be so totally overwhelmed in the way they were never occurred to him. There was no contingency plan. Very poorly thought out.
Not in the way they did it. Not in the way, yes. Oh, yeah, overconfidence. Very overconfident, yeah. And so if he anticipated an attack, he was hoping his 10 guns would be able to keep the Americans at bay. The reason why they brought all those cannons out there, for 1,500 men, 10 pieces of artillery is a lot of guns. And the reason why he does it is to try to instill fear in the Americans to keep them away. Because the Americans don't deploy artillery to the battles. They have artillery, but the artillery's back in camp. And for all Burgoyne knows, they have no cannons at all. So when the Americans attack, they only attack with infantry. And he's anticipating that his elite troops, lined up on an open field in an advantageous position, with defensive artillery, shooting a case shot and round shot at the attacking Americans, is going to be enough to keep the Americans away. But it doesn't. It doesn't. If anything, it entices them forth to show Burgoyne that, you know, we mean business and we can do it. But if you want that, I can send you that paper. Just give me, or tell you what, I could give you my card.
Oh,
okay. You can send me a note, and I'll be happy to share that. I go to more depth on that subject.
You're welcome. Welcome.
Well, thank you all for coming today. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seriously, that's no joke here.
That's some man-made.
Well, it's possible.
Good on camera. I just want to get that front writing up.
Thank you. A lot of energy. Thank you. Glad you're joining us.